Good morning. I'm going to talk about electromagnetic field dynamics in binary neutron stars. That is a work that I have done in collaboration with Louis Lehner, Steve Liebling, and Chris Thompson, and with the help of our long-term collaborators, Dave, Eric, Matt, and Chad. And, well, there are many things I wanted to talk about that have been already mentioned, so the talk may be a bit shorter than I prepared. The first thing is that with the new detectors of gravitational waves, there is going to be a new era of gravitational wave astronomy where we will be able to study some systems not only in the electromagnetic band but also in the gravitational wave band. So this will open the so-called multi-messenger astronomy where we can have more information of the physical processes involved in the systems. For instance, this is an example where we have a binary black hole merger immersed in an external magnetic field, and this system will produce both gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves, and we can correlate the both spectrums. So this is one of the purposes or the targets that we want to study. So some ongoing projects related to these electromagnetic counterparts to gravitational wave signals would be the binary black holes that I just mentioned that may be important in the context of supermassive black hole mergers in galaxy mergers. The black hole neutron star binary where the electromagnetic fields from the star extract energy, kinetical energy from the black hole, which propagates along the magnetic field lines and hits the surface of the star, producing a hot spot along the lines suggested by McNamara in his last paper. And, well, we are also working on this, but I am not going to talk at all about this in this presentation. And finally, the main... what I'm going to talk about is about the... interaction, magnetosphere interaction of a binary neutron star. So with the upgrade of LIGO, it is supposed that we will be able to detect like around 10 binary neutron star mergers per year. Well, neutron stars are very compact objects, so if we want to describe the dynamics properly and get the gravitational waves, we need to use GR, because there are some effects that we don't see in GR when comparing with Newtonian theory, as Matt was pointing out in his talk. And most of the neutron stars present some magnetic fields which range from 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 12 Gauss, which can even go higher in the case of magnetars or very young neutron stars. So in principle, the mergers of neutron stars are going to produce a hypermassive neutron star, which will collapse to a black hole surrounded by a massive accretion disk, which is the scenario where we expect to produce short gamma reversts. So how can we model the electromagnetic fields in a star? So a simple way to do it is to assume that we can divide all the space in three regions. In the region inside the surface of the star, the magnetic pressure is small compared with the fluid pressure. So this region is dominated by the fluid, and the ideal MHD is a good approximation, or provides a good description for this region. Then there is a region outside the star where the magnetic fields, the magnetic field pressure or energy, is much larger than the fluid pressure and fluid inertia. That region, that is called the magnetosphere, is dominated by the electromagnetic fields, and in particular, it can be it's more convenient to describe it with the four-free, what is called the four-free approximation, that I will describe a bit better later. And then if we move far away from the star, we get into a region where there is almost no plasma, we are mainly in vacuum, maybe with electromagnetic fields. So in principle, it's doable to solve any of these regions separately, but they are difficult to match, mainly by the reason that in one of them, in each of them, we are using a different limit of the Maxwell equations that I am writing just here in flat space time, and supplemented by the Ohm law with a scalar Ohm law. So in the ideal MHT limit, we are taking the formal limit where the conductivity tends to infinity, so we can, the electric field can be written in terms of the velocity and the magnetic field, just to get a finite current. And then we have a closed equation for the magnetic field in terms of the magnetic field itself and the velocity. This approximation will be valid inside the star, but outside the star it's easier to solve what is called the four free equations, where the condition that the magnetic pressure is much larger than the density and the fluid pressure imply that the Lorentz force is going to be zero. This is the Lorentz force condition, so we have to evolve Maxwell equations with a current that is given by this condition. And again, if we go far away, we have no sources, no charges, and no currents, and so we only have to solve Maxwell equations in vacuum. Now, if we want to study a neutron star, well, neutron stars have magnetic fields at the interior, but these magnetic fields will also, well, also spread out of outside the stars, cover all the magnetosphere in a sort of dipole structure. So if we have two of these stars with magnetospheres around them, during the spiral there will be a shear between these magnetospheres that can change the topology of the fields and produce dissipation regions, reconnections, and maybe an outflow of energy. So up to now we have been doing these evolutions with ideal MHT, and where the magnetic fields were confined mainly, at least initially, inside the stars. So we were not caring about what was happening outside, basically because we couldn't trust the results in the magnetosphere. So the question is, well, if we want to study what is the interaction of these magnetospheres, how can we match these two regions, the magnetosphere with the inside of the neutron star? What I'm going to introduce now is a new approach to do this matching, which can be split in four steps. Well, in the zero step, we have to solve Einstein equation because we want to correlate gravitational waves with electromagnetic waves, so we have to compute electromagnetic waves, well, sorry, gravitational waves properly, that have to be done with GR. In the first step, we solve the MHT equations, ideal MHT, everywhere, although we know that they will all only provide a good description of the electromagnetic fields inside the star. And in order to do that, we just write the total stress energy tensor as a combination of the perfect fluid one plus electromagnetic one. The evolution equations are given by the conservation of energy and momentum and by the Maxwell equations supplemented with the ideal MHT condition. In the second step, we are going to solve the four free equations. Well, we have another set of variables that will be the four free electromagnetic fields that we are going to solve everywhere by using, as I said, Maxwell equations with a current given by the four free condition, that is this condition here. And we know that this solution is going to be only valid in the regions which are magnetically dominated, that is in the magnetospheres. And just to explain a little bit, the four free approximation is that, as I said before, the total stress energy tensor has a part of the fluid and a part of the electromagnetic field. By using Maxwell equations, we can write this conservation as the Lorentz force. And if we assume that the magnetic field is much larger than the pressure at density, these terms here will be much larger than the terms here. And reading from right to the left, this term will have to cancel by itself, basically. And this is the Lorentz force. So this is where the force free condition comes from. And then in the last step, we are going to force the force free solution to be exactly the ideal MHT solution inside the star, where we know that the electromagnetic fields are reliable. So we have, we evolve ideal MHT by itself, we evolve force free by itself, and then we force the force free to be equal to the ideal MHT inside the star. So what we are doing is providing some sort of effective boundary conditions for the electromagnetic fields for the evolution in the magnetosphere. Well, this is a new approach and we have to test and check that it's giving the right results. Well, we have done some tests. The first is just to prove or to show that we can evolve binary neutron stars with magnetic fields which are confined by using the ideal MHT. This is something that we already did in 2008, where we show we compare binary neutron star in spiral and merger of non-magnetic and magnetized neutron stars. We were studying the differences on the dynamics at the merger and what gravitational waves were producing, as Dave was talking in his presentation. We have also to test that we can evolve force free reliably. And, well, we have been studying binary black holes immersed in external electromagnetic fields sourced by a circumbinary disk, and where the magnetic fields were described by the force free condition, the force free approximation. And what we saw in that system is that the magnetic fields surface or apparent horizon is pulling the magnetic fields due to its motion, and this pull or this deformation is propagates along the magnetic fields as an half-band wave. So you are extracting kinetical energy from the black hole motion, and this energy propagates as a flux tube along the magnetic field lines. So these are a few snapshots of the evolution, and where you can see that this dual jet that is formed at the black hole in spiral and merge, there is an important or significant isotropic radiation at the time of the merger, and just after the merger we recover the Blanford-Nanjing effect for a spinning black hole. Well, and now that we have proof or shown that we can evolve the ideal MHT and the force free separately, we have to test the matching of the two solutions. And a good test for that is what is called the line rotator or the pulsar solution, where we have a neutron star that is spinning fast, which has some dipolar magnetic field. The magnetosphere is, in this case, described by the force free approximation. And what it had been obtained in the past by some people, also Kontopoulos in solving the Grad-Shafranov equation, or Komissarov, Makinen, and Spitkovsky through the evolution of the equations until that they relax to the right solution, is that the initial dipole, or the magnetic fields of the initial dipole, starts to co-rotate with the star up to the light cylinder, and then the magnetic fields have to open to in order to not rotate faster than the speed of light. So in all these simulations, the neutron star is only accounted by boundary conditions, so they actually don't have a neutron star in their domain, but they account the effects of the neutron star rotation just by boundary conditions on the electromagnetic fields in an internal boundary. So what we have done instead is using a real star that is described with ideal MHT that is rotating, and have an initial dipole field that I am plotting here. This is the surface, the density of the star. And just evolve with our passive magnetosphere approach or hybrid approach, where we match the force-free solution here to the DLMHD in the interior. And what we see is that just after that period, we get a solution that is very close to the aligned rotator solution. So this gives us some confidence that our matching is, at least in some cases, giving the right solution. So now that we have tested a bit the, or we have checked the approach, we can go back to the system that we wanted to study, that is a binary neutron star that we see from the top here, with each of the stars with an initially dipole magnetic field. And we will evolve until during the spiral and merger. What we will see is that, well, the initial data is not perfectly consistent. So there will be an initial transient where the magnetic fields will reaccommodate in the exterior region. But and after almost an orbit, you will start to see that the magnetic fields start to co-rotate with the binary. Here in the right, you can see a close look of one of these times, where you see the density of the stars and how some magnetic fields from one star reconnects with the with magnetic fields from the other stars in this shear region between the two stars. So you know, well, it's a bit complicated to look only at the magnetic field, so it's easier or more intuitive to look at the radiation. Now we are looking in the front of the binary, where I am plotting in red and yellow the pointing vector. And you can see that, well, this is the initial transient, and just after the initial transient, there is some radiation. It is propagated more or less, or emitted more or less isotropically with a maybe with a maximum along the diagonals. So this means that due to the interaction of the magnetospheres, there is already some electromagnetic radiation getting out of the system or being extracted from the system. This case was, in this case, we were considering that the magnetic dipoles or moments were aligned with the angular momentum. But we can also study what happens when, for different orientations of the dipole. And in this case, for instance, we are considering an anti-aligned magnetic moments, up-down. In this case, you can see that there are more emission along the set axis. So there is a sort of collimation and then a big burst at the merger. And then after the merger, nothing, basically. So we can integrate this luminosity in a sphere to compute the total radiation. I am showing here the radiation for three cases. These are the case with the magnetic moments are up-down, where we see more radiation. And then I have, just for comparison purposes, the same up-up case, but where we are now describing the magnetospheres not with force free, but with electro vacuum. And in this case, the emitted radiation is three orders of magnitude smaller. So this means that the force free approximation is not only the right one, but also gives a very different result from the electro vacuum approach. Just making, well, we're still analyzing the data, so these are just preliminary results. I had to say it at the beginning, not at the end. We can make some calculations, order of magnitude calculations, and see that the radiated energy is like 10 to the 44 Hz, that is emitted like in 10 milliseconds, so that gives us a luminosity, an average luminosity of 10 to the 46 Hz. arcs per second. And since we expect a very hot and dense plasma around the stars because of the shaking of the magnetic fields, we expect it to be optically thick. That will absorb this electromagnetic radiation and remit it again as a black body, emitting with an effective temperature of probably around 10 to the 9 kelvins. So that means that there will be an electromagnetic counterpart before and at the merger in the hard X-rays or soft gamma rays. Just notice that I put here a box. It's not because the simulation is crashing or it's doing something strange. It's only, as we were saying before, we cannot trust, or we don't have resolution to trust what the magnetic fields are doing at the interior of the star at the merger. So there will be this Kelvin-Helmholtz instability that, in principle, will increase or will pump the magnetic fields up to 10 to the 16 Gauss, more or less, if we believe Priest and Rosegood. And we don't have resolutions to get that behavior. So in principle, here we may see some surprise if we would have enough resolution to describe properly that instability. Well, and just the summary, well, we have been studying different electromagnetic counterparts for gravitational wave events, binary neutron stars, mixed binaries that we will present in near future, supermassive black holes in circumbinary disks that could be observed by LISA if we see it someday, or with the pulsar timing array. In all these cases, the four free regime is a good approximation to describe the magnetospheres, where we have seen that the magnetic field can extract not only rotational energy from the stars or from the black holes, but also kinetical energy. And in this case of binary neutron stars, the interaction of the magnetospheres change the topology of the fields and produces a collimated, in some cases, radiation or before the merger. That maybe it may produce a precursor of short gamma reverse. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
You go back to the previous slide. So your luminosity estimate comes out of the pointing flux of your electromagnetic field, right?
Yes, we compute it.
So that's sort of the outgoing something that you get from your force-free approximation. I do not think that the approximation that you're making below setting the luminosity that you get from the pointing flux of the EMB fields, setting that equal to a thermal black body stuff has any meaning.
Yeah, well, it's a very rough estimation. It's just...
Yeah, I think it's not justified to say there will be a EM counterpart. I think there may be, but this is extremely hat-wavy setting this, you know, your outgoing EMB E cross B equal to a thermal black body. Not what should be done.
No, yeah, I just wanted to give an order of magnitude or at least some number for this talk, but we are still analyzing the data and we have to do.
You have the same thing with pulsars where you're having these converging magnetic fields and you're having electric fields. You're assuming a force-free plasma, but in reality there may be gaps in electric fields like in pulsars where you could be generating a lot of pairs, electron-positron pairs, just by accelerating particles along these electric fields. So if you were to make enough pairs to make this entire region opaque, and this EM field was absorbed. I mean, there's a possibility, I guess, you could thermalize it and produce...
I have to admit that I am not an expert in radiation processes, so it's just a few things that I have read and some comments from some people. But I am open to listen any suggestion about better ways to compute the luminosity and estimates on the frequencies and the processes which are involved.
maybe a little bit of follow-up along this line. If it makes any sense to think of some sort of photosphere, what would be the geometry of that photosphere?
The geometry of the photosphere.
Your question is about the magnetic field topology, for instance. You want to.
If the luminosity is 4 pi r squared in some black body, what is the 4 pi r squared? What's the area and what's the shape?
Yeah, well, in this hand-waving calculation, I was considering that the r was the separation between the stars because, well, what the simulation show is that most of the dissipation or where there is reconnection sit in a plane between the two stars, but mainly with the same radius at the, of the separation. So.
So, could I ask a question about your effective boundary condition? Is its energy consistent in the sense that as you go along, is the consistent amount of energy pass through the surface, or do you have energy losses completely from the simulation?
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how big they are?
What, sorry?
Do you have any idea how big these numerical losses of energy are through that surface?
You mean the dissipation in the... Sorry, I think I didn't...
My understanding is that when you set the interior or drive it to be force-free,
mm-hmm.
You're not guaranteeing energy conservation across the surface of the star. You're assuming that it's approximately correct, but you're not guaranteeing it in any sense. So
yes.
Given the numerics is stable, I'm assuming that you must be losing energy somewhere artificially.
Well, in the test that we have been doing with the line rotator, it showed that the dissipation of energy there is very small. So, well, that doesn't explain or that doesn't, you cannot extrapolate to what happens in a binary, but I would expect that it will not be too much. Or at least I am, well, we have ways to see if there is something obviously wrong or too large at the surfaces, and we see... We didn't see anything as too strange.
Sorry, a related comment. So I'm not sure. First, let me push back. I mean, you seem to imply that unless you lose energy, you're not going to have stability. As you said something like, given that the code works, you're losing energy. But I don't know where that comes from. So what this is doing is, so there is definitely an inconsistency in that there is no back reaction of the force-free onto the fields of the magnetosphere.
Yeah. Before discussing the details, I actually meant to ask Carlos myself to give a little bit more details about this fourth step of how you're imposing this effective boundary condition.
Yeah, what we do is we set a driver that enforces the force-free solution to be equal to the ideal MHT with a exponential decay with a time scale that is short, it's like 1 or 2 m. And we do it in a region that is determined by the density. So we have a function of density that is basically zero at the interior of the star and jumps smoothly but very fast at the surface. And so we set the driver with that transition. With that transition function.
Yeah. So let me just add to it. So maybe the steps could be confusing. So there's everything is done at the same time, and the boundary condition is designed through something akin to the penalty method across the surface. And so going back to Ian's question, so yeah, there is the energy of the force free is not ever accounted on the effect on the magnetosphere, or on the ideal MHD. So you're obviously losing that part. And on the other one, you're just matching it in a continuous fashion through the surface. So, I mean, there is some energy that is lost, but we don't think there is a major thing.
I'm still the chair. Okay. So let's thank Carlos again.